Chapter 29. My Life as a Train. I have always liked trains. One day, when he was about 6, Cubby and I drove to the Conrail freight yard in West Springfield. The tires crunched with a pop-popping sound as we rolled over the gray stone that covered the yard and filled the space between the train tracks. My father had taken me to see the trains when I was little, and 30 years later, here I was, doing the same thing with my own son. My father let me drive a train when I was 5, at the museum in Philadelphia. I would soon do the same with Cubby. I guess a fascination with trains runs in my family. When my father was little, his grandfather took him to watch the steam engines passing his drugstore, back in Chickamauga, Georgia. And here we were, over 50 years later, doing the same thing up here in Massachusetts. Cubby looked out the window, scanning the lines of boxcars. He was a 50-pound kid, bouncy, with a blue-striped train conductor's cap on his head. If he were a dog, he would have been wagging his tail. We had driven 45 minutes to see trains, and we were ready for action. We clumped across a few lines of track and parked next to the yardmaster's shack, an old wood building that had faded to the same shade of gray as the stone ballast on the ground. The train dispatcher was watching us through the dirty plate glass windows, and we waved. Oily smoke curled from a rusty pipe chimney. Everything was drab and dirty because it was dusted with years of soot from the diesel engines in the locomotives, which at that time ran 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. This train yard has been there since the days of steam engines, 50 years ago. So even before the soot from the diesel engines, there was a pretty thick layer of coal dust. Cubby likes being clean, so it's good he didn't know any of that. When he got bigger, he would develop the same compulsive hand-washing habit as his grandfather and his uncle. But even then, he hated getting grease on his clothes or on himself. I tried to keep him out of the worst of the dirt. "Look, Dad, F-types!" Cubby shouted as he pointed to 2 long silver FP-40 locomotives on the far side of the yard. He'd picked out an Amtrak passenger train that stood out among the freight cars filling the yard. It's unusual to see Amtrak trains idling among the trash and squalor of a freight yard. We walked over to check it out. As I was about to cross a few lines of track where 50 old boxcars were quietly rusting away, Cubby shouted, "Stop!" At 6 years of age, Cubby already knew to stop and look carefully before crossing the tracks. After watching the parked train cars for the slightest sign of movement, we quickly jumped over the tracks. We stepped over some crack vials left by last night's visitors. "Look, Cubby, do drugs, lose your mind, and get run over by a train," I said. "How come there aren't any pieces of people on the tracks?" he asked. "Maybe they got dragged farther into the yard." Cubby lost interest in drug addicts as we approached the FP-40 locomotives, which rumbled at idle and hissed occasionally as excess air popped the safety valves. Why were we there? Because Aspergians are driven to learn all they can about subjects that interest them. And one of my favorite subjects has always been transportation machinery. When I was learning to read, my favorite topics in the encyclopedia were trains, ships, and airplanes. And my favorite books for a time were High Iron, A Book of Trains, and Automotive Technology. As we walked around the engines, Cubby spotted a little pile of beach sand in front of the wheels on the front locomotive. He asked what it was. "It's sand from the train engine sandbox," I said. Cubby was skeptical. He was used to being tricked. He had a sandbox at home, one that he and I had built. But trains should not need sandboxes. His ears twitched. We moved closer. "Look, Cubby, that's the sandpipe, and that's the box where the sand is stored on the engine. The train engineer pushes a button to dump sand on the wheels when his wheels are slipping. Trains shovel sand in front of their wheels to get traction." I felt comforted knowing this exposure to the practical application of technology at an early age would benefit Cubby for the rest of his life, especially with respect to understanding traction issues. As I pointed out, Cars use Sanders, too. Cubby would nod sagely at tidbits of knowledge like that. Later, when he thought I wasn't looking, I would catch him explaining traction to the other little animals at his school. I felt very proud of him at times like that. A little engineer. As Cubby grew bigger, so did the engines. Conrail was making a change from the older General Motors locomotives with DC traction motors to the newest GE units with AC traction. On later visits, I would explain the advantages of AC traction motors to Cubby, and I even showed him the inside of one of the new cabs with its sophisticated control panels. The big new engines were impressive to watch, especially pulling heavy loads. After watching the trains in the yard, we decided to go out and see them on the road, and I knew just the place. One spring day, we drove to Middlefield, where the railroad crosses a pass in the Berkshires on the way to Albany, New York. We turned off the highway and followed a country road up into the mountains until we passed over the railroad. Shortly after, we turned into a wooded road that ran about a mile to the tracks. Up there, the air was fresh and clear. The sky was a brilliant blue, a shade you never saw in the city. Water was running in a little waterfall down the rock face where the railroad line had been blasted through the mountainside. The tracks hugged the side of the mountain, with a drop of at least 100 feet into the Westfield River on the other side. There were two tracks side by side, with a service road next to them. We walked up the service road and waited for a train.
"Look, Dad!"
Cubby threw rocks and watched them hit the water far below. He looked around for wildlife.
"Think we'll see any bears?"
Cubby sounded hopeful.
"You can get a gun, and I'll shoot it. Mom will skin it, and we'll eat it. Let's find a bear, Dad."
Cubby was bouncing up and down at the thought of catching a bear for dinner. But we didn't see any bears. Pretty soon, we heard the rumble of an approaching train. Over the next few minutes, the noise got louder until the ground began to shake. Cubby and I moved closer to the edge, away from the tracks. The tracks began to sing, and we saw the headlights come around the bend. Even from a few hundred feet, we could feel the engines as they struggled to pull the train up the hill. By the time they reached us, they were moving at a brisk walk, which was all the speed 15,000 horsepower could muster going up that hill. They struggled past us as we stood on the gravel road and watched.
"Sanders, Dad!"
Cubby shouted as the second of 5 engines went past. Sure enough, the sand pipes were pouring sand in front of the wheels to help the train get a grip. Cubby was proud of himself for picking up that detail. Cubby waved, and the engineer tooted his horn. 5 engines passed us, then 133 cars. Cubby counted them all, and all of a sudden it was quiet again. After a moment, we turned and walked back down the hill.
"How can anyone get run over by a train out here?" Cubby asked.
"We could hear him coming for a long time. You'd have to be deaf to miss that." And then, without any warning, a train appeared behind us, rolling fast down the hill, going the other way on the other set of tracks. Silently, it came up on us so quickly that the startled engineer didn't even have time to blow the horn till he was 50 feet beyond us. As the engines passed, we jumped a little farther out of the way, and I pointed to the air shimmering in waves over the engines.
"Those are his dynamic brakes," I explained.
"They use the electric motors on the wheels as generators, and the generators are feeding huge heating grids on top of the engines. So they're using the motors as brakes, converting the energy of the train into heat. The locomotives don't make any noise, because their engines are idling." Cubby bobbed his head a bit as he soaked up that idea. The train continued to roll past in near silence, picking up speed as it went. Cubby didn't ask how people got run over by trains again. As we walked back to our Land Rover, we picked up 2 old railroad spikes to add to our considerable collection of railroad memorabilia. I'd been picking up pieces beside train tracks since finding those telegraph insulators with Little Bear 15 years before, and now Cubby was continuing the tradition.
"Don't all the dads take their kids to see trains?"
I wondered. I guess not, judging from the crazy looks I've gotten from other parents. Mothers would say things like, "How can you take a child into a train yard? He could get killed." Well, nothing killed us. Nothing even came close. Cubby and I were well aware of the enormous weight of these trains. I showed Cubby how objects can trail from the sides of moving trains, and we made sure to stay 10 feet back whenever a train went by, so we didn't get hit by any loose steel strapping. All those visits to train yards with Cubby probably had at least something to do with my favorite book as a child, The Little Engine That Could. The book had a yellow cover, with a bright blue locomotive driving across the page, and when I was 2, I couldn't hear it often enough. "Choo, choo," was what I said when I wanted to hear the story. My mother read it to me over and over. I would huff and puff and imagine myself as a little steam engine. The harder I puffed, the more convinced I became. A few years later, I became lost in the fantasy that I was a pair of windshield wipers, but at the time, I was in my steam engine phase. In the book, it was only a steep hill the train had to climb. But in my 2-year-old brain, it was a giant mountain, bigger than anything I had ever seen. The engines chanted to themselves as they slowly climbed the hill. "I think I can. I think I can. I think I can. I think I can." And I would chant along with them. I would bounce, too, with the effort of pulling that train. Today, I know that head bobbing and rocking back and forth and bouncing up and down, things I still do today, are characteristic of people with autism or Asperger's. But that's where it started, with me believing I was a steam engine, pulling those cars up the mountain, bobbing up and down, and bouncing. Eventually, we got to the top, that train and me. As we coasted down the other side, I grinned happily and bounced and said, "I thought I could, I thought I could, I thought I could, I thought I could." Somehow, I always remembered that refrain as I grew older. It was very reassuring. But while I kept telling myself I was going to make it, I would also hear competing voices, at times quite loud and forceful. They were hard to ignore. "You're no good. You failed at school, and you'll fail at this. You're just a fuck-up. It will never work. You can't do that. You belong in prison." I'm sure many kids hear voices like that as they struggle to grow up and make it on their own. And some kids give in and quit. I know that because I see those children every day. You can see them too, sleeping in cardboard boxes in any city. I tried sleeping in boxes and dumpsters back when I was 17. I didn't like it, and I resolved never to do it again. All the bad things that have happened to me in my life have simply increased my resolve to overcome the obstacles that are thrown in my path. And I've done that with reasonable success so far. But those voices were still there. And as I got older, they began to emanate from other people too. The message was the same. "You're so anxious and worried. You should try antidepressants." "John, you need to relax. Sit down and have a drink."
"You know, smoking pot calms you down. You should try it. You might not be so hyper all the time."
I don't know why, but I never gave in to the voices. Many times quitting would have been easier than going on, but I never did. And I never turned to antidepressants or liquor or pot or anything else. I just worked harder. I always figured I'd be better off solving a problem as opposed to taking medication to forget I had a problem. I'm sure antidepressants, drugs, and liquor have their place. But so far, that place is in others, not me. When I heard the voices as a child, I would say to myself, "I think I can, I think I can, I think I can." As an adult, my vocabulary and my world have expanded. Now, "I think I can" is reinforced by, "I did it before." But the negative voices are smoother and more sophisticated, too. Now when I hear those voices, I tell myself, "All the other guitars worked. This one will, too. The other jobs came out fine. This one will too. I am sure I can walk up this mountain. I think I can drive across that river. And so far, with some notable exceptions, I have. Epilogue. When Kiss was on tour, we'd always come out and do one last song, an encore. This is the encore for Look Me in the Eye, the story of how I made peace with my parents during the writing of this book. My father had been in precarious health for years, with psoriasis, arthritis, diabetes, and a weak heart. But in the late summer of 2004, a spider tipped the balance. A brown recluse spider. Brown recluses live in woodpiles, sheds, and attics, sometimes even in shoes, and seldom bite unless cornered. We think my father was chopping wood when he was bitten. In any case, a few days after he was bitten, his finger swelled up and began to hurt terribly, and my stepmother, Judy, drove him to the emergency room. I had never heard of a brown recluse until then, so I went home and researched them. They are only the size of a quarter, and most people don't even notice when they're bitten. Still, the bite of the brown recluse can be worse than the bite of a rattlesnake. The skin around my father's bite turned black, and a hole appeared, right down to the bone. Brown recluse bites are rare in New England. Of the 400 bites logged in one database, only 9 were in Massachusetts. Most were in the South. It was my father's bad luck to be one of those 9 in his weakened state. His finger looked awful where he'd been bitten, and you could smell the sweet odor of gangrene. I thought they should cut his finger off right away to save him, but the doctor insisted the finger was still alive, so they held off. My father seemed to hold his own with the IV antibiotics, but he remained in a lot of pain. I wondered how long he'd be in the hospital. When he wasn't in the hospital, my father and Judy lived in a 1970s contemporary house that they'd added on to and made their own over the 20 years they had lived there. The main room had a cathedral ceiling and a wood stove in the corner. The stove burned wood my father and Judy cut together on the property. Bears and raccoons came up onto the deck, and the snow drifted higher than my head in a cold winter. They'd moved there after getting married, each for the second time. My father had never been especially sociable. He may have had a little bit of Asperger's himself, so a home in the woods suited him. He spent his days outdoors puttering around the property. He had grown up on a farm in Georgia, and he'd always wanted a tractor of his own. That summer, he had taken delivery of a brand new John Deere 4510 with a cab and a front end loader. Now he was too sick to drive it, but he'd be able to look at it through the window while he waited to get stronger. I lived about an hour away, but my father seldom called me. The only days I could count on his calling were my birthday and Christmas. And after my son was born, I'd hear from my father on Cubby's birthday, too. Any other time I wanted to talk to him, I had to make the call. And even then, he only came to the phone about half the time. Yet he always enjoyed seeing us whenever we went there. I never figured it out. Why didn't he call? By November, my father was back home, still weak but hoping to get better. Although he was pretty much bedridden, my stepmother got him into the car and brought him to our house for Thanksgiving dinner. We were all together, me, my mate, Cubby, my father and Judy, and my brother and his partner, Dennis. We even had Martha's sister, Unit 3, and her mate, 3B. Everyone looks happy in the photos I took that day. At 9 o'clock on New Year's Eve, I got another call. Your father was wandering around and he fell down the stairs to the garage. The ambulance is coming for him now, Judy said. This time, she sounded scared. It turned out to be a pretty bad fall. He'd broken his back and his hip. He was lucky he hadn't been paralyzed. He survived an operation to repair the break and was put in a cast to keep him still. Once again, he was in a lot of pain. After a couple of weeks in the hospital, he went to a nursing home to recover. They told him he had to be able to climb 2 flights of stairs and walk 200 feet before they would let him out. He was determined to succeed, but it was hard. We went to see him in late January, and he looked as if he had a basketball in his stomach. Judy said he was retaining fluids because of trouble with his liver. Martha felt sick because her mother had died of cancer the year before, and that's how her stomach had looked. It was not right. Not right at all. They let him go home on February 25th. He was able to walk up the stairs and get around with the help of his walker. It was going to be a long road, but it seemed as if he was going to get better. A week later, we went to see him. He could barely sit up. His stomach was swollen up like a beach ball, and his scrotum was like a grapefruit. He did not belong at home. While I was there, he had to go to the bathroom. Judy and I helped him stand, and he moved the 5 feet in his walker at a glacial pace. He said, "John Elder, don't let me fall. I'm so scared of falling." At that moment, he was once again a small, terrified child. My confidence in his recovery was shaken to the core. A few days passed. The swelling in his stomach worsened. His liver had been damaged by years of drinking, then by all the medicine he'd taken for his psoriasis and his arthritis. On Monday evening, Judy called and said my father was being taken to the hospital again. Somehow, I knew this was going to be different from all the other trips to the hospital. I realized he was dying. I rounded up Martha and Cubby and headed for the hospital. On the way there, I was angry because I could not remember a single good time we had shared when I was young. When we arrived, he was very weak but lucid. He seemed glad to see us. I sat there for quite a while thinking that asking him for better memories would be an admission of his impending death. Finally, I did it. "Can you tell me about any fun times we had when I was small?" I asked. I waited for the answer, terrified by the prospect that there might not have been any fun times. What would I do then? But he began to speak. "When you were 5, he said, "I'd take you to the museum in Philadelphia. They had a big model train layout, and you loved to watch it." And he turned to my son and said, "One day your dad asked the man in the booth if he could drive the train, and the man said yes. Your dad climbed into the booth with him, and he drove those trains all over the board with a big smile on his face." I had forgotten about those trains, but when my father told Cubby, I remembered it like it was yesterday. I said, "After I drove the model trains, your grandpa took me to another part of the museum where they had 2 real locomotives." "Baldwin's," my father piped up. "The locomotives were made by Baldwin Locomotive Works in Philadelphia." I was shocked that he remembered. A few years before, I had read a history of the Baldwin Works, but I had no idea my father knew about it. As he told his stories, things I had forgotten for almost 50 years suddenly came into focus, clear as day. I remembered the spring I learned to ride a 2-wheel bike on the paved walkways outside the Cathedral of Learning in Pittsburgh. I never used training wheels. I went straight from a toy fire engine and a trike to a big kid's 2-wheeler, and I didn't crash or fall off. I was really proud of myself. My father said, "I got you a Rollfast bike, just like I had as a kid. Yours was a space racer with a red gas tank and a coaster brake." My father had a black Raleigh, an English racer, with 3 speeds. We rode them together. When I outgrew the Rollfast, he gave me the Raleigh. He'd sort of given up riding bicycles by then. I could not help sobbing as he talked. "Do you remember Valley Forge?" he said. I remembered running across the fields of Valley Forge National Park, chasing the kite he made me. I remembered both of us running in the sun, my mother watching from the shade, until I fell and tangled the string around my ankle. To this day, I have a scar there. There had been fun times after all. When we left that day, he could see I was sad. He smiled and patted me on the head and said not to worry about him. He said he would be okay. but inside I knew he wouldn't. I wished I were small again. From that time until the end, I visited him almost every day. He got weaker and weaker until one day he said,
"John Elder, I'm dying."
"I know. It's sad," I said. "Where do you think you're going to go?"
"It's a mystery," he said. "No one knows."
"Are you scared?"
"No, not really."
Judy made plans to move him back to Buckland the following Tuesday so he could die at home. My father said,
"Will you be okay?"
I said I'd be sad, but I'd be okay. He said,
"Will you look after Judy? She's been really good to me."
I said I would. He asked if I'd help Judy with the house. I said I would. He asked about his tractor. I asked if he'd like me to get his tractor out for him to see one last time. He said he'd like that. Then I sat for a couple of hours and talked with him, my mother, and Judy. He became tired, and I left for home, promising to return that night. I was very sad. I stopped at my brother's and told him the end was near. Afterward, I cried, and I wondered why dying people asked me to look after what was left. My great-grandfather Dandy had asked me to take care of the farm. My grandfather Jack had asked me to take care of Carolyn and to take care of the fields and the trees his father Dandy had planted. Well, it's been more than 20 years, and those things are all gone now. Carolyn died, and the house burned, and the trees and fields are all gone. But I guess I did what I could. I returned just about every month to Lawrenceville from the time my grandfather died until my grandmother moved away. Judy said it's hard being the oldest child. She's an oldest child, too. Monday, I went to work. A few hours later, Judy called.
"They're going to bring your dad home today. He's getting weaker. We can't wait till Tuesday."
It was time to move the tractor. I gathered up my tools, my shovels, and my winch cables. There was no telling how deep it would be buried after the winter snows. I went by the school and picked up Cubby. We would move the tractor together. It was spring in Amherst, but it was still winter in Buckland. The snow was waist-deep in the field, and the tractor was sitting 100 feet up the hill next to the shed. The bucket on the front of it was not even visible. Neither were the front tires. Still, the sun was shining, and the tractor started right up. I put it in gear, and it shook, but didn't move. I tried to lift the bucket, but it was frozen to the ground. I rocked it and twisted it, and all of a sudden it came off the ground with a bang, filled with a foot of ice.
"Let's dig it out, Dad."
Cubby and I dug around the wheels until the tractor emerged from the snow. We dug the snow away from the front and the back to give it room to move. I rocked the gears, but it didn't move. We dug some more. We were sweating even though it was 35 degrees outside. As we shoveled around the back, the drawbars emerged from the snow. The arms were frozen right into the ground. Kicking them didn't do anything, but a pull on the hydraulic lever in the tractor broke them free. Now the tractor moved. A whole foot.
"Dad, look! The front tire is flat!"
Cubby was right.
"Damn, Cubby! How are we going to get a 3-wheel tractor over a 7-foot snowbank and into the driveway?"
Cubby said,
"Let's winch it."
Our Land Rover had a good winch on the front. Cubby waded through the snow to get to the Rover. He angled it in the driveway so it was pointing out into the field.
"Here's the cable, Dad."
Cubby had dragged the line through the snow so I could hook it to the tractor. Cubby waded back to the Land Rover and started the winch. I got in the tractor, put it in 4-wheel drive, and locked the differential. That tractor rolled right through the enormous snowbank and into the driveway. When the tractor came out of the snow, Cubby saw it first.
"Dad, look! The front tire is gone!"
There was nothing but a bare steel rim. The struggle to get out had torn the tire right off the rim. We fished the tire out of the snow and levered it back onto the rim with 2 big bars. We installed a tube and got that tractor back on all 4 feet within 30 minutes. Then we set to work moving the snow to make room for all the cars and the ambulance. That tractor could really dig, and I was sorry my father would never get the chance to see it run. The sound of the diesel engine, the smell, and the activity were a good distraction for us. I showed Cubby how to run the loader, and he shared the snow moving with me. A picture I took that day shows him with a big grin, lifting a huge bucket of snow and dropping it down the hillside. We got the snow moved, and when we were done, we parked the tractor right by the stairs and sat down to wait. The ambulance arrived, and the two attendants pulled my father out the back. He smiled when he saw me, and he looked at the tractor. He couldn't talk much. I asked if he wanted to go over to it, and he said no, he was cold. But he smiled again. Cubby and I helped carry my father into the house, and then onto the bed. Finally, he was home. I stood for a while and held his hand. My brother came up, and he got some old photo albums and showed them to my father. But my father couldn't concentrate. He said he'd have to look at them later. I gave him a hug, and I said I loved him. Very faintly, he said, "I love you too." And that was the last time I saw him. He died quietly at 2:30 in the afternoon the next day, while I was at work. It was a sunny, late winter day. I got up and went home. It was over. The tire went flat on the tractor the next day. In place of my father, I have my memories. For so many years, I could not recall anything about him except the bad and the ugly. Now stories and memories that were lost to me for 30 years have taken on life. I hope they stay. Other memories began to stir too. Today, at 50, I can feel my bare feet sting on the sharp white pebbles in the dirt driveway of my grandparents' house, and I can hear the crickets. I can smell that Georgia clay and my great-grandfather's pipe. I can hear the twang as I reach up to open the screen door on the front of the house, and I can feel the cold floor as I step onto the black and white checkered tiles. It is these memories, a last gift from my father, that have made this book possible. Although some memories were as vivid and real as today, others were spotty. So in an attempt to get more answers, I spoke to my mother. I had been estranged from her for some time, but we began talking as I wrote this book. At first, my mother had a hard time accepting that my memories could be different from her own and still be valid. She'd say, "You weren't in the back of that VW that trip." And I'd say, "I was too. I remember the sky." We both learned something from that. My mother was troubled by some of what I'd written about her. After we talked, I understood that I had made one or two errors in my portrayal of her, and I corrected them. In other cases, she and I have different memories, or we interpreted things differently, and she came to accept my version. I believe the process of writing this memoir gave me a better understanding of who she is and how mental illness affected her, and I know she gained a better understanding of me. For much of her life, my mother dreamed of being a well-known author. She published a few works of poetry, but the larger work of a memoir always eluded her. She had the skills and the stories, but her life got in the way. The mental illness that gave her experiences to write about also prevented her from capturing them on paper. Her stroke and partial paralysis made it hard for her to write and hard to think. But she hasn't given up, and I'm confident that her story will appear in bookstores one day soon, alongside her postcards and poetry. There is no doubt that the storytelling skills people see in my brother and me were inherited from my mother. Whatever flaws our parents had, they were exceptionally intelligent, articulate, and creative. It's a shame that my father died before my book was written. I hope he'd be proud if he read it now. I think he would, and so does his brother, my Uncle Bob. I'm afraid my portrayal of him may be less forgiving than it might have been, because he was not here to offer explanations that may have moderated some of my harshest descriptions. With the insight gained from writing the book, I now believe my parents did the best they could under tough circumstances. They were both damaged as children, and my brother and I grew up damaged as a result. But damage is not always permanent, nor is it always passed down from one generation to the next. I'm okay today, and so is my brother. Cubby has never been whipped, and he has never known the rougher things my brother and I experienced. Hopefully, he will avoid those dark corners of life. I've already heard Cubby tell little James about the dragons. He makes his own fireworks, and the math and computer programming he does is already beyond me. So as much as he'd deny it, Cubby is a lot like his dad. It will take a few more years, I hope, but I'm looking forward to the day when I can watch Cubby take his own son to the train yard to watch the locomotives. This is Mark Deakins. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Look Me in the Eye, My Life with Asperger's by John Elder Robison. Published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Group, a division of Random House, Inc. Text copyright 2007 by John Elder Robison. Production copyright 2007, Books on Tape.